Hello, my name is Sam Clements, and welcome to The Love of Cinema, a Picture House podcast. I am your guide through this episode of the podcast. I'm very much here in a linking and hosting capacity because, as always, we are joined by two special guests, two guest film critics, in fact, to talk about the movies that we'll be playing. Not all of the films that we'll be playing this month. There are too many films coming out, but if we've picked a handful to talk about on the show where we thought we could have an interesting conversation. So this month we are joined by Stephanie Banbury, a wonderful film writer whose work I have followed for publications such as Deadline, and also a wonderful film critic, Wendy Mitchell. So many amazing credits to her name, and books and live events and panel moderation. And this year, esteemed film critic Wendy Mitchell is going to be the producer of Sundance London, the Sundance Film Festival London, which is a spin-off, I suppose, of the very famous Sundance Film Festival that takes place in the snowy town of Park City in Utah every year. So we bring sort of like the greatest hits of the Sundance Film Festival to the UK at Picture House Cinemas, exclusively at Picture House Central in the heart of London. And Wendy is producing the festival. So film critic, film writer, festival producer, Wendy Mitchell. Very lucky to have Wendy on the show because Wendy's very busy planning the Sundance London Film Festival this year. But she took some time out to talk to Stephanie about our films this month. So really pleased to have those two on board. We have also got a special guest about halfway through the show. Delighted to welcome legendary filmmaker Sam Raimi to talk about his brand new film, his latest installment in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, Doctor Strange and the Multiverse of Madness. And he'll be talking to one of our previous podcast hosts, wonderful film critic Amon Warman. So that's all coming up. But before we get into the meat of the show, whilst we're still at the bun level, it's May 2022 and cinemas across the UK reopened a year ago this month. They reopened in May 2021 with a host of films that were due for release many months and even years before that. But of course, the pandemic caused cinemas to close a couple of times in the past couple of years. But we have been open solidly for a year. Interestingly, in this edition, a year on, we're talking about a couple of big sequels and a couple of interesting independent films as well. So that's all coming up. But yeah, I just thought I'd just take a moment to reflect and say congratulations and sort of think about where we were a year ago and compared to where we are. It's a huge achievement that we've been able to stay open for this year and carry on screening films as the filmmakers intended. And I've certainly enjoyed going back to the cinema a heck of a lot in the past 12 months. And I do, every time I go, I do have this newfound appreciation for seeing a film on a big screen after, you know, 18 months or so of just watching films on my TV. I love going to the cinema and I do not take that for granted. 1 year on with some incredible films, that's quite enough waffle from me. I think we should start talking about some movies. For those who haven't listened before, every month we invite two esteemed film critics on, a different pairing every month. We like to keep it fresh to review a handful of films coming to your local picture house over the course of the next 4 weeks. And first up on this show, first up for Wendy and Stephanie to review, we're going to go back to Downton Abbey. There's a brand new Downton Abbey film in cinemas, a sequel, second feature film after six seasons of a TV series, and this is Downton Abbey, A New Era. So here we go, Wendy and Stephanie talking about Downton Abbey.
Action! Cut!
Sorry.
The modern world comes to Downton.
Okay, so we both went to see Downton Abbey. We saw it together. Wendy, I noticed you turning away to have a little dab at the eyes a couple of times. Don't think I wasn't watching. Tell me about your reaction.
Well, we saw it at that glorious big screen, Picture House Central Screen 1. Going into the film, I was like, oh, do I care about Downton Abbey anymore? And then Yes, I do. Steph, I could have sat there for another 2 hours, just immersed in the Lord Grantham's world with Lady Mary and my old friends. I don't think you were dabbing your eyes at Dame Maggie, but yeah, I got so into it. And I feel like it's the part of your brain. Sometimes I watch a film and I'm like, you know this is not great art, but I am loving it. I am here for it. And that's how I was with Downton Abbey, A New Era. What about you?
Well, that's more how I feel in Fast and Furious. But with this, I have to say, well, yes, I mean, I shed a couple of tears too, because it's so calculated to make you do that. It's a Pavlovian response. You can't stop yourself.
You know, I'm addicted to Coke Zero. I'm addicted to Downton Abbey. I think I've seen every episode of that TV show. I love a bit of sort of soft Sunday night television. I would absolutely go see a Call the Midwife movie, if you're listening. I find it impossible to look away. It feels like catching up with old friends. It was transporting entertainment. You know, I didn't think about the real world for 2 hours. And I think sometimes great cinema, you do think about the real world. And I think we'll talk about some films like that later. But with this, yeah, it was like Sunday night telly and a warm bath and a, you know, a lavender candle burning in the corner. And I needed that. We've had a rough few years. I can use a little bit of Downton Abbey, A New Era. I will say that title is misleading. I think Downton Abbey, A New Era would be, we pick up the story in 1982 when, you know, one of the grandkids is growing up and it's turned into a squat and a crack den. It's still very much those old world traditions. I mean, I look forward to Downton Abbey, A New Era at some point in my life, but this is not a new era. And to me, that's why it was good.
Downton Abbey, A New Era is in cinemas right now. I have to confess, I have not seen the Downton Abbey TV show, but hearing Wendy and Stephanie's response to the film made me curious to see this film. It sounds right up my street. I'd love a cathartic cry at the cinema, especially if it's in sort of a bit of a silly film, and it sounds like that might fit the bill in both parts. Last time I cried at the cinema was the Jennifer Lopez film Marry Me. Moving swiftly on to something completely different, and something I'm really excited to, that is finally coming to the UK after playing at various film festivals across the world. It's the brand new film from Gaspar Noé, Vortex. And what's interesting about this film is it's not your typical Gaspar Noé film. If you know the director's work, I'll let Wendy and Stephanie talk about this because they'll do a much better job than me. But Vortex is coming to your local picture house cinema on the 13th of May. On est bien peu de choses, et mon ami La Rose me l'a dit ce matin.
Pourquoi tu es parti? Qu'est-ce que tu as pu passer? Je te cherchais partout, par tous les quartiers.
So, Vortex, this is Gaspar Noé, the enfant terrible of French cinema, as we've never seen him before. He is looking at an elderly couple, and what they're doing, she has dementia, he's struggling to take care of her, he's struggling with his place in the world. You know, I tend to prefer my Gaspar Noé, you know, drugged out, swirling cameras in a disgusting toilet. So this was a change of pace. I think it is probably one of his finest films. It's great to see him taking some of those stylistic flourishes that he likes and putting them in just a more everyday dramatic story. Stephanie, how did you feel?
I thought it was fantastic. I've just seen it for the second time yesterday. And I, as you know, the screen is divided into two the whole time, and most of the time the screen is on one is on the husband and the wife. The wife has got advanced dementia. The husband is trying to cope and is not coping because he too is very old. So we see them both living their lives around each other within a very small space within their flat, and what the little things that they do all day that are kind of, at first you have the sense that they're weaving around each other in a kind of old marriage, constantly attuned way. And then you gradually realize that the wife's pursuits around the flat, let alone around the neighborhood, are directionless. She often doesn't know where she is, what she's doing. A phenomenal performance, giving the sense of her fear and disorientation and her husband's ignorance often of what she's doing. Even though he's just in another room, he thinks she's fine. In fact, what she's doing is chopping up his new book or being about to set fire to the house. And at the same time, he doesn't want to worry their son, who has got his own worries because he's a recovering drug addict. He's obviously been in another Gaspar Noé film. He's trying to take care of them, but he can't. He's got a child to look after. Every now and then he comes into this double picture of sometimes we see him on his own while we see them in another of these split screens. And like all his films, it's a technical triumph. What I really marvel at is the way he's able to use mostly a handheld camera within a tiny space, constantly revolving it, making the sense of what's going on in these people's minds almost inscribed by the camera movements. It's just a fantastic piece of work, I think.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, especially technically, I mean, just formally inventive with this split screen. And it's not just, you know, his POV and her POV or camera on him, camera on her. It's a little bit more nuanced than that. And I found it, yeah, incredibly moving. I cried in a different way than I did with Dame Maggie. Yeah, no, I think deep is a great word for this film. I mean, I think you can marvel at its technical achievements. This is pure cinema. You must see this on a big screen. Amazing performances by Francois Lebrun and Dario Argento, of all people, playing the father, the husband character. But it really did make me go a bit deep on sort of what is life? What is our existence? You know, are we all going to die alone? Are we dying alone slowly in the last few years battering around a flat with each other? So, yeah, it's not necessarily a light or funny film. You know, there's a few moments of levity, perhaps. But, yeah, there is some tenderness in this film. And it's such thought-provoking cinema. Just it is art and it is cinema. And, you know, when I heard Gaspar Noé and Dario Argento are working together, you think it's going to be some kind of crazy drugged-up horror film. And in a way, it's a horrific in some ways, but it's not in the way that we thought. It's not the monsters under the bed or anybody getting slashed, but it is real, the sort of existential dread of life.
They do have a drug element, of course. The son is a recovering junkie, or not particularly recovering, and or trying to recover. And the point is constantly made that his parents are both on sweets of pills. And there's one rather poignant scene where you see his mother, who, as is revealed quite soon, was a psychiatrist, flushing all her pills down the toilet. There is a sense of, yes, they're both, everybody's dependent on drugs in this film. At one point, Dario Argento's character says, we're all enslaved to drugs. So there is a bit of traditional Gaspar in there.
Yes, there is. I think there's enough for Gaspar Noé fans. I mean, my favorite film of his is probably Enter the Void. And, you know, there's still swooping cameras and swirling and, you know, in this film, just in a much different way. So I think if you're a Gaspar Noé fan, you need to see this film. If you're a fan of inventive cinema, you need to see this film. If you can't face getting older and dying alone, you need to see this film. So I can recommend it. It's, yeah, a real major piece of work.
Thank you, Wendy and Stephanie. That film is incredible. I totally agree with what Wendy and Stephanie said. It premiered at the Cannes Film Festival back in July, I think, in 2021, and it's played a whole host of festivals. It's opened in a few countries around the world, and I think yeah, cinephiles in the UK have been waiting eagerly for this film, and it's so interestingly put together on the big screen. I highly recommend seeing this one in the cinema. I guess if you know Gaspar Noé's films, you know that he uses the screen in an interesting way, and I think this is kind of the peak of him sort of doing his thing, but it's something different to what he's done before, which is also exciting. We have a great relationship with Gaspar Noé at Picture House Cinemas. Picture House Entertainment, our sister distribution company, are releasing this film, and we had the opportunity to ask Gaspar Noé to pick some of his favourite films to show on the big screen to celebrate the release of Vortex, and he's basically picked five bangers for us to show to audiences alongside his movie. They're not necessarily films that inspired Vortex, they're just films that made him want to be a filmmaker, and those listings are all online. I'll put a link in the show notes. I'll just drop a couple of names, but do check our website for the full listings. We've got Bird with a Crystal Plumage, we've got Tokyo Story in there, we've got Sunset Boulevard, and a couple of others. And yeah, so there you go. So you can thank Gaspar Noé for selecting those films very kindly. And he actually wrote a little bit about those in the new issue of the Picture House Recommends magazine, which is free to pick up at all good Picture House cinemas. All Picture House cinemas, they're all good. So you can pick that up. You can read more about the season. And we have an interview with Gaspar Noé about Vortex in there too. We're just going to pause the film review section of the show, and I think now's a good time to bring in our special guest for this episode, director Sam Raimi, one of my favorite filmmakers. And when I heard he was available to do an interview for the podcast, I got so excited, and I realized I was away on holiday, I couldn't do the interview. So I called good friend of the show, Amon Woman, one of our previous podcast co-hosts and interviewer on the show. He interviewed Pedro Almodovar a few months ago on a previous episode, to ask if he'd like to talk to director Sam Raimi for us, and Amon thankfully said yes. So this is Amon Woman talking to our special guest, director Sam Raimi, about his brand new film as part of the Marvel Cinematic Universe, Doctor Strange and the Multiverse of Madness, starring Benedict Cumberbatch, Elizabeth Olsen, Benedict Wong, an incredible cast. I haven't seen the film yet, and I'm excited to hear this interview. So without further ado, Amon and Sam.
Someone once told me that the reality I thought I knew was just one of many.
Welcome to the Picture House Cinema Podcast, Sam Raimi.
Thanks, great to be here.
I know you consciously took a superhero sabbatical after Spider-Man 3, but Doctor Strange was on your short list of heroes you jumped behind the camera for. What is it about this character that makes you such a fan of him?
Well, he was very different than the other heroes that I like so much, from Spider-Man, Superman, and Batman, who are always like fighting the bad guys. Doctor Strange's job was so much bigger than that. His concerns were cosmic. He had to protect the Earth and our universe from terrible forces beyond, you know, tremendous spirits and demons beyond our understanding. And it was always a little spooky and very important. So I thought it was very different than all the other heroes that I would follow as a kid. And I really liked that.
Do you remember your first day on the set of Spider-Man? And how does it compare to your first day on the set of this film?
There were so many warm-up days to the Spider-Man shooting. We had so many tests to do because we were trying to figure out how to bring off Spider-Man on the screen. Would he be on wires? Would it be a lot of blue screen? Would it be front screen or rear screen? Would it be done with matte photography or animation or CGI? And so the actual days of that those testing went on for months, and they kind of blurred into the first day of photography for me. So I couldn't tell you where one ended and the other started. But I do remember the first day of photography on Doctor Strange. It was very exciting. We shot in north of London, and it was a great crack British crew, which I had never worked with before. I'd only shot movies in the United States before. And it was invigorating to work again on such a beloved character as Doctor Strange.
As a common thread between Multiverse of Madness and Spider-Man 3, which is heroes and their hubris, why is that particular theme something you'd love to interrogate?
Well, it just happened to be the theme of both. It's not that I particularly love that theme, but with Doctor Strange 3, with Doctor Strange 2, it had a natural ability to have the main character reflect upon their own flaws, because the multiverse is in fact nothing but a mirror, sometimes a funhouse mirror, so where the main character can look at alter versions of themselves, and it's really a cause for self-reflection. And because Doctor Strange was a flawed character in the first Doctor Strange film and in the subsequent Avengers film where he made guest appearances, it was only natural that eventually that character would look back upon himself and have some self-examination. And this was the ideal film for that. And this character happens to be plagued with a little bit of egotism, a little bit of hubris. So it just naturally turned out to be the theme of the film.
Well, I wanted to follow up on that because I find that interesting. Doctor Strange is such a fascinating character because while his ego and his arrogance, as you say, have led to some questionable decisions, if he doesn't have at least a little bit of that, I don't think he even attempts some of the things that he does to save the world, as he has done on multiple occasions now. So my two-part question is this. What can you tell us about the lesson that Doctor Strange is trying to learn in this movie? And is having a little bit of arrogance and ego a good thing?
I think having the skills and confidence that Doctor Strange has is a key ingredient to his heroics and his effectiveness as a hero, like you're suggesting. But I also think in his case, some of it stems from a deep-rooted insecurity. And some of it is just a facade that he builds up to hide the scared little boy that he is inside.
I want to relate that to filmmaking a little bit, because I think that all of us have some semblance of ego about ourselves, maybe small, maybe big. But you are the Sam Raimi. You're director of The Evil Dead, Drag Me to Hell, Spider-Man. How conscious are you of keeping your ego in check and maybe channeling it in a positive way as opposed to a negative way when you're directing?
I try and really value the things that I think are important, and I try and make them important in the movie. So I guess I value my ego. You know, I try and recognize what it is that I find great about Stan Lee and Steve Ditko's Spider-Man creation, and I try and bring that to the screen. I never try and say, oh, the audience will like this, because I don't know what they would really like. I just think I have to focus on what I like and be true to it. And if I truly like it, I know that I'm connected to every audience member. I'm just another human being. And therefore, what I like, they must like some part of. And so that's a lot of ego to have that assumption and follow through with it. But I found it to be an effective tool in crafting the movies that I make.
Absolutely. One thing I love about both the Spider-Man movies and the Multiverse of Madness footage that I saw was the fundamental heroism on display in terms of this person is in trouble. I need to drop whatever I'm doing to help because I can. And for my money, we don't really see enough of that in superhero media these days. So what do you feel is lost when we don't include that? And how important was it for you to bring that to Doctor Strange?
It's very important. I think that everybody's got to do what they can to help where they can to be a human being in this world. And if we can't show that in our heroes, I don't know where we can show it. Certainly in a fantasy superhero picture, you've got to have some of that. I completely agree with you. That's the basics of the superhero fantasy for me. I can, so I will. I'll help.
Absolutely. I want to ask a little bit about the post-production process on this movie, because I was a little bit surprised when I saw that the final runtime was actually 2 hours and 6 minutes, maybe because I'm projecting and just thinking about all the film, all the stuff that the film might deal with. And I know that there's always reshoots, and you hear reports that you guys are shooting 3 different versions of the same scene. How challenging was it to figure out exactly what to use and what to discard when it came to the post-production process on this film?
It was really no more difficult than any other film, which is basically impossible, because you're trying to both keep the main character's journey front and center, but you want to round it out with the additional characters, and you want to support themes, and you want to have interesting points of view on the bigger picture. So it takes a little bit of everything, a distant eye on the overall idea that the audience really doesn't want to sit in that theater seat more than 2 hours, in my opinion, and the attention to detail and depth of detail that the fans desire, the in-depth desire to see the nuances of one universe and what it feels like, what it sounds like, what it looks like in the most intricate of ways. So it's a really a balancing act. And I think audience test screenings are a great tool for that, to sit in the crowd and feel when they're getting something, when they're into it, or where they seem to be pulling back a bit. You can feel that energy drain out of the crowd a bit, and then you know you've got to go in there and make some changes.
So it's been 15 years since you made your last superhero movie. Is there anything that you had access to on this film that you wish you had back then?
Yeah, the great communication tools that we have with modern day computers and Zooms, like you and I are speaking on now, or the ability for a director to not just have a meeting with 30 people, but 300 people all around the world simultaneously, to be able to share designs to each and every one of them, for one of them to be able to speak up and put up a piece of multimedia for the team to see, for the editor to then interject in that meeting and show the current cut of the movie and where the problem is, and to indicate it, to blow up a piece of the set visually on screen and to say, this is what we need to manufacture for this reshoot. We need to do an insert in front of this piece. Can we build that piece of set? It's incredibly specific now and so much more advanced, the ability to communicate. And that's all directing is, after all, is communicating your vision of the story to your team and letting them make the movie.
One thing that is, again, true of some of now and then is Danny Elfman. You worked with him on the first two Spider-Man movies. You bring him back for Multiverse of Madness. What sort of conversations were you having with him about what the film needed musically?
Well, it started with pre-production discussions, seeing if I could secure him for the movie. And he said yes. And I was so happy, because it's like having your soulmate. It's like having your best friend and your a very talented storyteller helping you tell the story, but through their medium, music. And suddenly they've got your back. And it was a great relief. And he provided pre-production music and themes, which I really needed, because there was some musical pieces of Danny's in the movie that I needed before we started shooting even a single frame. So his creative process even preceded my own. He created a drum theme for Carmitage, which we'll visit in this movie, but he also created a simple song that is sung within the narrative of the film.
Oh, fantastic. So did you have the music playing frequently on set as you were directing?
Well, it was more of a war drum piece that he made. But yes, okay. We did choreograph to that. Fantastic. And it was very important.
Awesome. Can't wait to see that scene. So we've had Spider-Verse. We're about to have Everything Everywhere All at Once. We've got this movie. Why do you think the concept of multiverses is so fashionable right now?
I don't know why that is, but the only guess I can make is that the internet and our experiences with seeing things from so many angles at once and seeing so many versions of things like the Ukraine war, both Russian propaganda lies and real footage from the Ukrainian side, have given us multiverses within our own reality. And so I think it's logical to extend that into the world of fantasy.
You mentioned multiverses there. In the course of making this movie, did you find yourself thinking about different choices you might have made in your career and what they might have led to?
This movie didn't really make me think of that, you know, working on this movie, because it's not so much about a reflection backwards as it is moving forward and the possibilities of what we could become if we made different choices from this point forth. At least that's how I looked at it. But I try not to look back too much on the wrong choices I'd made. I made so many wrong choices that my days would be filled with nothing but that. So I try and look forward, try and spend time in my garden and with my children and think positive thoughts and not about the mistakes I've made in the past, because they can overwhelm any of us.
Absolutely. I know you said that directing is the only thing you know how to do. How early in your life did you realize that that was your path? And is there an alternate version of you somewhere in the multiverse who decided to become a doctor or painter, etc. instead?
Well, I decided to become a director. I didn't actually think it was possible to become a director. I loved making movies, but I thought that at some point, the real world would make me stop and I'd have to go into the retail business or some other aspect of modern life that I didn't really want to go into. So I just kept staying to make movies as long as I could. And I somehow escaped any other life. I was very fortunate to follow my dreams and have this opportunity.
And finally, Doctor Strange in the Multiverse of Madness will be playing in UK cinemas very, very soon. What is it that you love about the cinema experience?
I love the community aspect of it, how you're with sitting with strangers and watching an intimate story of an individual on the screen, and each and every person in the audience has a connection to that person. And in so doing, they together, the audience has a community connection. They all feel heartbreak at the same moment. They feel longing and hope. And in the best of movies, they feel uplifted and they are shown what's possible to do. Right? That's what the best stories do, is show us the best that we can be. And that's why I love the superhero movie genre. It oftentimes when it succeeds, it has that effect on me.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, Sam Raimi, I can't wait to sit with a few strangers and watch this film. Thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. It was a lovely interview.
I still can't quite get over Sam Raimi on our podcast. That's very cool. Thank you so much, Amon, for doing the interview. And thank you, Sam, for talking to us. Doctor Strange and the Multiverse of Madness is in cinemas right now. I haven't seen it yet, but I genuinely have booked my tickets for opening night, which at time of recording is today. So I'm going to go to the cinema later on and watch that. Looking forward to it. Pitch House Central, Screen 1. And now our final film review for this podcast. Wendy and Stephanie review the brand new Nick Cave and Warren Ellis music film, This Much I Know to Be True, directed by Andrew Dominik. And this is an intimate concert film, documentary film, performance, I suppose, by Nick Cave, Warren Ellis and their bandmates. And it's exclusively in cinemas for one night only on the 11th of May. And then down the line, it will be made available on home entertainment, I believe. But if you want to see it on the big screen, you got to get out to the 11th of May screening.
This is the devil in remorse. He's alone and separated from the world.
My compatriots, Nick Cave and Warren Ellis, in This Much I Know to Be True, directed by another of my compatriots, Andrew Dominik, are in this documentary, if you can call it a documentary. It's actually sort of a concert film, although it takes place in a warehouse. It's a record of their work. It's a record of their relationship. And it's a picture of their professional lives that I found really involving, beautifully shot, transfixing, perhaps lulling in the way that you found Downton Abbey lulling, you know, kind of washed over me. And I loved it. So there we are. I know you weren't as enthused.
Well, I admire this film and I need to explain why. Yeah, beautifully shot. Nick Cave also just, he's like a tent preacher. He's such a captivating performer. Andrew Dominik is a world-class director, bringing all his skills. I mean, the lighting, Robbie Ryan's cinematography, it's all wonderful. Here's my confession, Stephanie, is that I used to be a music journalist. That's not the confession part. I struggle with live performance on film, music performance. And I'll tell you, it's because I love live music. I don't want to see it necessarily on a screen. I want to be in the room. And I know that's not been possible with COVID. And, you know, this is very much not just a concert at, you know, the O2 or something. Nick Cave and Warren Ellis and their collaborators are in some kind of special, you know, concert just for Andrew Dominik to capture. So it's not like I could have gotten a ticket and gone. But I just get a little bit bored watching music performance on film. And I've never admitted that in public before. I just really want to be in the room. But having said all that, Nick Cave, totally captivating performer. I love, you know, seeing more of his collaborative spirit with Warren Ellis. And, you know, I like the little details in between the performances even more than the performances.
Including their digs at each other.
Exactly. And my favorite was seeing Warren Ellis's, I think it's his laptop desktop, you know, with thousands of files dumped on it. I wanted to go in there immediately and clean it up. And I want to know how his mind can be so creative and so good at what he does and have chaos on his computer.
Well, that's his own word for it. He said, actually, when I interviewed him, he said, yes, I realized I'm a really chaotic person. I'd never realized that until I saw this film. Not even while I was making it. It was only afterwards I realized that how chaotic I am. And he said that other people also want to come and clean up his computer, so there could be a queue when you get there.
There you go. Maybe I'll join the queue to clean Warren's computer. I just love this stuff that shows me more about the human being behind the performer. So I loved seeing Nick Cave opening up about, he has this kind of agony aunt column that I didn't know about called The Red Hand Files.
Oh, that's great. You've never read that?
I have never read that. And just seeing he was, gosh, so eloquent in speaking about this and how he has to sit with a question before he can answer it. And also seeing his ceramics workshop. This is a beautifully made film. And if you're a Nick Cave fan, you're going to be in heaven. And even if you don't know if you like Nick Cave, this would be a great introduction to his work, his process, his spirit. What an amazing human being.
His spirit, certainly. Although, of course, it's not as poppy as his other work. I mean, it's very much Requiem material about his son and his death and about his life now, being reconciled to that. But it's not entirely an introduction to his musical oeuvre, but it certainly is a picture of their lives. And I felt I was in the room with them.
As is tradition, at the end of these podcasts, we like to ask our guest film critics what is currently on at their local picture house that they'd recommend we see before it leaves the big screen, and what they're looking forward to watching in the future. I'm looking forward to hearing what Wendy and Stephanie would recommend.
One film I recommend that's still in cinemas is The Northman. This is going to absolutely be one of my top films of the year. I have a very professional obsession with Claes Bang, the Danish actor, ever since I saw him in The Square in Cannes about 5 years ago. He's fantastic. Alexander Skarsgård appears to have been working on his abs a little bit. But this is immersive cinema. I mean, I don't think we'll ever see another true-to-life Viking story like this. And you feel the blood, the guts. It feels like you're there. It is primal. It is a little bit bonkers. And oh my gosh, I can't imagine watching this on your sofa. See it on a huge screen while you can.
I wanted to match you with another Scandinavian film, and there are so many on our screens at the moment. But I couldn't go past The Happening, Audrey Dewan's film about, set in 1963, about a girl, young woman, who discovers that she's pregnant and has to try to get an abortion in a situation where, in a country where abortion was not only illegal, but anybody who had one or who aided and abetted somebody who had one, like drove them there, could be arrested and tried. So this is a situation that is about to re-erupt in your own home country, Wendy.
I'm afraid you're right.
And so it's very much of the moment, but it's at the same time very much of its period. It's not a flag-waving film. It's not a hysterical film. It just builds the picture of what is happening to this woman and the people around her, stone by stone, and inexorable and curiously entertaining way. I mean, you actually do get a very strong sense of the life of 1963, just before the 60s happened. And I really loved it. And I think that anybody who saw it would maybe think that they were going to see something a bit on the heavy side, but you would come away glad you'd gone.
Loved it too.
I know that you are going to talk about a film that's one of the Cannes competition films. So I thought, well, so will I. And who could go past? Crimes of the Future, David Cronenberg. I am so excited to see this film. David Cronenberg reunited in Crimes of the Future with Viggo Mortensen, playing a kind of stage performer who demonstrates changes in his bodily organs on stage and is being pursued by some sort of government inspectorate headed by Kristen Stewart. It's just classic Cronenberg stuff. It's going to be visceral. It's going to be fearsome. It's going to suggest ways that people could be or ways that people already are that are just spine-chilling. And, of course, it'll be a fantastic imaginative ride.
I'm also going to be in Cannes. I will see you there, Steph. I am so looking forward to, I'm going to stick with my Scandi folk. I'm so looking forward to Ruben Östlund's Triangle of Sadness. It's his first English language film. It's got a cast including Charles B. Dean, who I think is South African, and Harris Dickinson, an amazing up-and-comer from the UK. Woody Harrelson is in this film. It looks at, I think it's going to be a satire on the class system and beauty and youth. And I've heard there's a spectacular set piece that involves a lot of vomiting. I think it's going to be crazy. And I think Ruben always makes his films for the cinema. I'll get to see it in the Cinema Lumiere in Cannes, but it'll be out in cinemas sometime after Cannes for everybody to see on a big screen. And I think it's absolutely going to be worth it, whatever he brings to us.
I'm excited too.
So I'm also the producer of Sundance Film Festival London 2022, which is coming to Picture House Central June 9th through 12th. And three of the films are going to be at cinemas across the UK that weekend. So many great films to recommend. I'm going to start with our opening night film, which is Good Luck to You, Leo Grand, directed by Sophie Hyde. It's starring Emma Thompson and Daryl McCormack. Amazing performances from both of them. They're both going to be with us on opening night in person. You know, before I heard the description of this film and I was like, this could be a bit cringy if they handle the humor in a sort of jokey way. But it's about an older woman who hires a sex worker because she'd only ever had sex with her husband and she wants to try something new. And I just thought it could be all like wink, wink, old ladies trying to get boned, you know, horrible. And it's really sensitive. It's really humane. I just love this film. Our closing film is going to be Brian and Charles by Jem Archer. This is a wonderfully eccentric British comedy. A man creates a sort of robot friend out of a washing machine part. The robot likes to eat cabbage. I mean, it's just wacky. It's so funny, but it's heartwarming. I also really love the documentary we have called Fire of Love by Sarah Dosa. And it's about two volcanologists. And that is the first time I've tried to say that word in public. And their passion for the environment and just amazing footage. And Miranda July narrates it. And it's, again, I think a film you would really suffer if you only got to see it on your TV screen. I think it's, yeah, one of the most cinematic films of the year. Can't wait to see that. With an audience, you know, that's the other thing is that some of these filmmakers haven't had the chance because Sundance in Park City, Utah in January had to go online. You know, it was for COVID safety. Some of these filmmakers haven't seen their films with an audience yet. And we're going to bring that audience to them at Picture House Central. Just also mention we're doing an industry program for the first time this year at Sundance London. And we have the amazing Christine Vachon of Killer Films in New York, Todd Haynes' longtime producer, amongst others. And she's coming to give a keynote, lots of other great speakers. So yeah, I'd recommend people go have a look at the Picture House website. You'll see all the offerings at Sundance London and you can buy tickets now.
Oh, thank you very much, Wendy Mitchell and Stephanie Banbury, for talking to us today, for being our guest film critics. Stephanie, Wendy, where can people find more of your work online if they'd like to read more?
I'm a journalist. I work for an Australian newspaper group. You can read my work on www.smh.com.au. That's the Sydney Morning Herald website. And I also review for Deadline, the American online industry magazine. And I will be reviewing from Cannes, that's for sure.
And great. Yep. Please keep up with me. I've got my own website, filmwendy.com. I've got a new book coming out about Icelandic filmmaking, a bit niche, but some people might be interested. And I will be writing in Cannes for screendaily.com. And as I mentioned, picturehouses.com/Sundance. And you can come see all the great stuff we've got going on at Sundance London.
Thank you to Wendy Mitchell, Stephanie Banbury for being our guest film critics this month. Thank you so much, Amon Woman, for stepping in and doing that wonderful interview. And thank you, Sam Raimi, of course, for joining the show. Such a thrill to have you on. And don't miss Doctor Strange in cinemas right now. As always, thank you so much to Kobe for producing this episode at Stripped Media. Couldn't make the show without you, so thank you, Kobe. And Maddie Searle, thank you for editing this episode of the podcast. You make the magic happen. We couldn't do this without you. A hero, always a pleasure. So thank you, Maddie. And I've been Sam Clements. This has been The Love of Cinema. If you like the show, please rate, review, subscribe on your podcatcher of choice. And we'll be back in June. Thank you for listening. Goodbye.